Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Founders Club Radio.
Welcome to the Founders Club, where each week we talk to the founders and leaders of great private companies. I'm your host, John Coffin, and this morning I'm joined in the studio by JT Waters, the founder and owner of Manassas Textiles. Good morning, JT.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us here. We appreciate you coming down from Rome this morning.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you.
Tell us about Manassas Textiles and what your firm does.
Well, essentially, we do two different things. On one side, we're a plastics recycling company. So we purchase waste from carpet mills and yarn producers pretty much in our area, but you know, anywhere in the U.S. And we recycle that back into a plastic pellet that is suitable for reuse and injection molding and things of that nature, automotive. And then the other side is we're a small niche carpet manufacturer. So the company kind of grew in two separate paths from its inception, and that's where we are today.
So tell me about the start. How'd you start the company, and which side of the business did you start with?
Well, it's kind of interesting. When I was in college, growing up in Northwest Georgia and being in the carpet industry, it's kind of like growing up in Detroit and having family in the automotive industry. It's just, it's the largest employer in our area. So my family, my grandfather was actually in the yarn spinning business, and my father and his brothers started a marine carpet manufacturing company. So I would work there during the summers when I was in college. And I remember one summer, I was actually a rising senior, summer before my senior year at UGA. It was 19...
Go Dogs.
Yeah, exactly. It was 2000, I think, and the internet was, you know, definitely out there, and the dot-com rage was happening. But in the carpet and textile industry, it wasn't, kind of on the forefront. So when I was working there during the summer, I noticed there was a great deal of waste that they were actually having to pay to dump. And I just got on the internet and found someone who actually paid them, you know, a decent amount of money for that waste. And so the proverbial light bulb went off in my head that, hey, maybe there are other carpet and textile mills that I could do this for. So I went back to school and kind of halfway cut class and halfway tried to make a go of a new business venture. And essentially I would, you know, not make a lot of money, but I would try to visit people and make as many contacts as I could, mm-hmm. and see if there were other carpet and textile mills that had waste that, you know, I could buy and essentially resell. So it started out as a brokerage company, more or less, where we were just buying their waste. And, you know, I'd made enough contacts and was confident enough when I graduated from UGA to make a go of it.
So was it the waste? It wasn't the waste to be recycled. It was actual carpet that was completed that was just odd lot or whatever. Is that correct?
That's correct. So okay. It would be in the manufacturing process. So when they would extrude yarn, there would be, you know, leftover pieces and bale waste from when they would change colors and things like that. So it was suitable for recycling, but really, essentially at this point, all I was doing was purchasing the waste and reselling it, you know, buying from A and selling to B and okay. taking the cut out of the middle. And that was actually a viable business for some time until really the world got smaller pretty quickly, I'd say in the few years after I began the business. And I realized that I needed to get a little bit higher up the value chain. So we actually started taking, we kept one leg in that business. So mm-hmm. where it made sense, we would still buy and resell and provide a service to our suppliers. But then also where it made sense, we would purchase yarn that was suitable to be reused back into rug manufacturing, and we would do that as well. So that's where the two tracks began in the company. So
I see.
One leg of the business was actually buying yarn, having it on a commission basis. We would send it to processors, and they would charge us per square yard to tuft it. Tufting is a process of taking yarn and putting it in the carpet. And then on the other side, we were still kind of in the true waste side of the business.
Okay.
And so that's how it's evolved. So it's gone on two tracks, but the if you think of a tree, the base is still the same, right? So a lot of our suppliers for both legs of the business are the same. So okay. that's the overlap.
And so talk about how both sides have grown over the years.
Yes.
It's just incredible that, you know, that you took an idea and then, as always, it seems to morph a little bit as it goes along and grow in different directions.
Well, I was really fortunate, I think, at the time when I started the company, right? So if you think back to 2001, it was the depths of the recession, I guess what we would call now a mild recession, but what back then seemed like a pretty significant one.
Right.
And then you had this huge boom in housing. So the demand for flooring products and you know, waste products was at an all-time high for the next probably 6 years or so, I would say. So a lot of it was just fortunate timing. Mm-hmm. so the flooring segment of the business grew pretty rapidly with the, you know, the ascension of housing and the increased construction that was going on. So it got to the point where our rug and carpet business was large enough to where I felt comfortable in building a manufacturing facility and purchasing our own equipment and bringing it all in-house. So that's what we did. And we actually moved into our production facility in 2008. So if you ever need any market timing advice, just feel free to ask me. I'm always available. So, and that was the that was for the rug and carpet manufacturing.
Okay. So who would be some of your customers that you sell to on that side of your business?
Well, initially it was mostly what the industry term is rug cutters. So we would make just kind of a cheap, you know, solid color carpet, and they would cut it up into 9x12s and 6x9s and put a binding on it, and they would package it and sell it to a Home Depot or somebody like that.
Okay.
We were selling to the people who would do that. And then that kind of evolved where we actually started making residential carpet. And where we are today is we do very little rug business, and almost all of our carpet production is what I would term niche residential carpet.
Mm-hmm.
Our customers are really small carpet dealers nationwide, small and large carpet dealers nationwide.
Okay.
We don't do any big box business or things like that. But,
right.
And then on the plastic side, you know, our customers are what you call plastics compounders.
Okay. So that the side of the flooring aspect of it's just kind of continued to grow and develop, and you've got moved into the manufacturing side of things.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the recycling piece and how that developed.
So the recycling piece up until about a year and a half ago was still essentially just me buying from Plant X and selling to someone who was recycling it. And then we decided...
So it used to be you'd get that waste for free. Now, then it kind of shifted into you had to buy it.
Right. Well, I wouldn't... Yeah, in the depths of the recession, some of it was free, yes. But right. I mean, there's always been a fairly active market for this material. But I mean, yes, you're right. I mean, the market definitely has grown a lot over the last 15 years. And a year and a half ago, we decided to make the plunge and bring that process in-house as well. So that's at a separate facility where we purchased what's called a remelt extrusion line. And we feed the waste material, in our case, nylon waste, and repelletize it. And the industry term is nylon repro. So that's essentially what we sell.
Okay, so that nylon repro is what does that then go into? Is it plastic molding?
We will sell it then to what's called a compounder. They'll take our product and they'll reinforce it. They'll add glass or rubber or some kind of stabilizer to make it suitable for injection molding for, you know, chair parts, automotive parts, things like that. So a good example would be if you open the hood of your car today. Most cars made today have what's called an engine cover on it. It's just a black plastic engine cover.
Right.
Whereas I don't think 25 years ago you may have seen that. Well, a lot of that is actually recycled nylon. So, I mean, ultimately, after us, before it goes to molding.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, it's just incredible. You're totally in the virtuous cycle here from the beginning to the end. It's great. How important has it been for you in starting the business to be in the carpet capital of the world? It's incredible to me. You think about Silicon Valley, or you think about some of the things in the new economy where, you know, it's really at the heart of knowledge base that begins to help the area flourish. Mm-hmm. It seems like that same thing has happened in the Cartersville, Dalton corridor over the years, and it's just remarkable to me.
No,
as an insider, agree. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, there's no question. I mean, the two businesses that we have could not exist if it weren't for our proximity to, you know, the carpet and yarn manufacturers, as well as the labor, you know, the skilled labor that's available in that area. So, yeah, I mean, this business would especially on the carpet side, would be, I don't want to say impossible, but it'd be very hard to do in Kansas, for example. I mean, you know, it's a lot of it definitely has to do with the geographic location, for sure.
Yeah. Well, so it's really it helps from a labor standpoint. I guess it helps from a trend standpoint as well. Mm-hmm. What are some of the new trends in your business that you're focused on these days?
Well, you know, we have, as far as trends, you know, I'm not really sure how to answer that question. On the plastic side, you know, I mean, recycling obviously is, you know, a buzzword, and green is a buzzword for everyone.
Right.
you know, the trends, and we're not in the post-consumer carpet, but that's a huge trend that's going on right now in the plastics business, and that's where they're actually taking carpet that's on the floor and recycling that. All of ours is what's called post-industrial, but definitely a big trend is post-consumer carpet, which is a little bit messier and has a little bit more involved for sure, but that's okay. That's a large trend. On the carpet side, I mean, you know, honestly, there's a lot of quote-unquote green trends on that side of it as well. I mean, you know, it's inefficiencies are becoming more and more important as well. I mean, the I guess if you want to term it the Great Recession, we had a lot of capacity shuttered during that three-year period, mm-hmm. and a lot of new capacity is being added in that industry that's a lot more efficient. So it's been an interesting 5 or 6 years in both legs of the business for sure.
Yeah, it really has, and it's sometimes in you know, the manufacturing space or in recycling, there's really innovation that's leap forward type of innovation, and then sometimes it's gradual. Mm-hmm. Talk about that in your business and how you've injected innovation into your business over the years.
Well, you know, we always kind of, my MO in my business is all of our equipment is older, so we always try to make a lot out of a little. So mm-hmm. If you walk through our tufting facility right now, you would see, you know, some warpers that were produced back in the Depression, old cotton mill warpers. So I'm not sure we're on the cutting edge of any innovation trends in our industry. But what you see and what you learn from a lot of these larger companies is kind of what's coming, and you can look ahead and kind of see the future. So, for example, in the carpet business, I mentioned the capacity shed and the new production that's being added. I mean, now you've got carpet mills that are super efficient. Everything's done under one roof,
right?
As opposed to, you know, you would have yarn made at one facility and then 15 miles down the road tufting, and then 15 miles down the road the finishing. Well, a lot of that's kind of all being put under one roof now, and it's a much more efficient. And I guess if that's innovation, that's the trend that where it's heading for sure.
Okay, I guess you've just said we're gonna have two locations, but they're gonna do completely different
right.
things.
Yeah, I mean,
so that's where you're getting your
that's
focus
exactly right.
from.
Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah, our focus is we really want to be very good at certain things and not lose focus on what we can do. I mean, we're a small company. We can't be everything to everybody, but we think we can be really good at service and price and customer relationships in certain specific markets. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we try to do.
Now, it seems like several of the raw materials that are involved in the business are in some ways linked to oil prices or mm-hmm. the petroleum industry. Talk a little bit about that, how you manage the ups and the downs, and we've had a little bit of both over the last 5 years.
Well, and the stress that goes along with that is one reason why I'm so skinny, I think, is what I tell everybody. But yeah, no, there's no question. I mean, you know, almost, I don't know if this is, my guess would be 90% at least of the broadloom carpet in the United States is petroleum based.
Okay.
And so, yeah, when you have one side of the business where your raw material is essentially a commodity that's based off oil on the plastic side, you know, if you have a lot of inventory and oil and the resins that you base that off of go from $110 a barrel to $45 a barrel, you know, you have to be nimble and quick and really watch what you're doing and watch your buying on the purchasing side.
Right.
But on the other side, I mean, and kind of one reason why I like having both legs of the business is that can certainly be an advantage from a margin standpoint if your input raw materials decrease, and you can do your best to kind of mitigate the decreases you have to have on the sales side. So
in some ways, I hadn't really thought about that. Your two businesses yeah. are somewhat countercyclical.
It's a little bit of a hedge.
Or complement each other.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a hedge. So oftentimes when the plastic side is doing really well, the flooring side will be soft and vice versa.
Okay.
And our really great quarters are when they're both doing well, which is, you know, it doesn't happen too often, unfortunately.
Right. But got to make hay while the sun shines.
That's exactly right. Right. That's exactly right.
As you were growing up in the business over the last few years since 2000, who were some of the mentors or people that really influenced your decision making or how you grew the company?
Well, I think, you know, certainly my father, you know, he and his brothers, as I mentioned, founded a company. And you know, my grandfather passed away when I was young. I was 4 years old, actually. But I think the stories I've heard told about him as well, not that he was a mentor, but I think it certainly has influenced me. And you know, there's several people. I'll tell you a story, though, that really... Just if you're out there and things are difficult, there's a man named Jim LeMay This is back when we had our office in Cartersville, Georgia, and I was right out of college, and September 11th had just happened. And I can remember I had an office, and I had my first employee, and business went from not great to just nothing. Mm-hmm. And I put my head down on the table, and Jim LeMay had a company called Quaker Carpets, and he was just always so nice to me. He was an older gentleman, and he would always welcome me in, and he would buy yarn from me and other things, and just treated me great. And I was to the point where I really didn't know if this was going to work, and if, you know, maybe I should start looking at doing something else. And getting a real job. That's exactly right. So the phone rang, and it was Jim LeMay on the other end, and he just said, "Hey, I know it's tough right now, and I just want you to know I think you're doing a great job, and keep your head up, and I appreciate all you do for us."
Wow.
And it was just, you know, that call at that moment, and Jim was kind of a mentor to me, and just a great gentleman. Mm-hmm. And so that is just a call that I'll never forget. And literally, it was kind of one of those things where I redoubled my efforts and put my head down and just kept going.
So. Yeah. That's just a great story about how the importance of, you know, personal touch. And
right.
Sometimes it just, you know, comes at the most important times.
Yeah, there's no question.
What about a recent accomplishment or milestone that your company's met that you're particularly proud of?
Well, you know, we have definitely hit some revenue milestones. You know, as I mentioned, we brought the recycling production in house, and I think, you know, we moved 24/7 in that operation, and we hit some production milestones as well recently. So the first quarter of this year was, I guess, a milestone quarter in several respects for us.
I'm sorry, you say move 24/7. You mean the
plant our production?
Is
yeah, going 24/7.
24/7.
Yeah, that's exactly right. 24 hours a day.
That's fantastic. And yeah. So, as you're kind of at that point where you're increasing capacity and you're starting to kind of think about the next stage of perhaps adding a line or whatever, talk about how you kind of think through that and mm-hmm. You know, some of the key components to those calculations.
Well, you know,
because frankly, that's the point in the cycle where a lot of people are right now. Mm-hmm. You know, they're either have invested over the last 2 years in new capacity, or they're really thinking about it. So, love your perspective on that.
Well, you know, I always like to see demand outstrip my supply before I make that kind of decision.
Right.
So that's a key component. I mean, am I confident that I can, you know, if I double my capacity, that I can sell that capacity fairly quickly? I mean, that's a key component, obviously. But the other thing is, kind of more for me, is I wanted to be sure we really had our arms around what we were doing, and that we were servicing our customers and had good relationships in place before we made that next step, because the efficiencies really are exponential, especially if it's in one location. When you double your capacity, all other things being equal, the employee add is less, right. The power add is less, you know, all the variable costs go down. But we just needed to get really good at what we were doing before we made that next step. So we're kind of still in that process of getting everything just right where it needs to be.
So, you know, going a little bit deeper into that for new business opportunities or whatever, how do you go about testing, you know, your hypotheses? Sometimes as the business owner, you're the guy or you're the woman who's really kind of making those critical calls. You know, I don't know. I talk to myself, you know, as I'm driving along, but, you know, sure. are there things that you do that are helpful?
Well, if we have three customers, and let's say right now we're 5% of their business, I mean, obviously the question to ask those three customers is, what are the chances of me getting 10% of the business?
Right.
And if the chances are pretty good, I mean, that's kind of how I look at it. And so existing customers are growing that base, and then, you know, additional organic growth of customers is also key to it.
Yeah, so you know, that's interesting too. You've talked several times about your service element and mm-hmm. how critical that is. You know, you're serving on both sides of your businesses, two different customers. Talk about that. You know, how you kind of drive that service element through your employee base and really ultimately to your customers.
Well, we have a great and dedicated team of people. I mean, that's really how we do it. I mean, it's all about our people. I mean, if it weren't for, you know, Robin and customer service and Harry and sales and Tim and the production, I mean, it just couldn't happen. So, I mean, the credit really needs to go to the whole team and the way they support our customers. I think kind of it's a top down feeling of, you know, credibility is a big deal to me, especially when you're selling the flooring side is a little bit different. Of course, not that credibility is not big, but I'm saying the sales process is a little bit more styling and price. On the plastic side, you're truly selling a commodity. Mm-hmm. So if you aren't credible in your delivery and what you say you're going to do, and you don't have a chance. So from the top down, it's got to start with me, with the customer relationships, to be sure all of our customers know if we say we're going to do X, we're going to do X. And if we say that this is apples, it better be apples, you know, right, that type of thing. So I think, you know, as with any organization, that has to start at the top and kind of trickle down. And, you know, hopefully our customers feel like that's what we've done.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other side of growth is finding those next teammates to mm-hmm. kind of help you grow. Talk about that in this environment. Is the labor market getting tighter for you right now?
Well, yeah, it is actually. If you ask me today what our largest challenge is, I think on the manufacturing side, it's labor. Mm-hmm. You know, we've actually struggled to find a couple employees for our plastic recycling side, and if there's a capacity, yeah, that's an issue we definitely have to deal with. I think if you look back in manufacturing 30 years ago, that was a big problem, and then that has been alleviated a lot, and now we've got that same problem again. And it's a great time to be a manufacturer in America, but that's my single largest worry about the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, I guess that's the benefit too of at least being in an area that has some density mm-hmm. from a training standpoint and from an history in the industry that hopefully there's, you know, that kind of next generation or people that are out there. Mm-hmm. Who in the community has been doing a good job developing those people?
Well, I think, you know, there's a big push with the technical colleges, and that seems to really be paying dividends. And I think in the future that will definitely pay a lot of dividends. You know, there's the pool of labor, I think, and I don't have any stats on this, but I feel like it has shrunk fairly significantly mm-hmm. since 2008. And I don't know if that's accurate or if the stats will reflect that. But so, you know, we're going to either have to pay more for labor in the future, and which will obviously work its way all the way through pricing. We're going to have more labor. I think there's just no two ways around it.
Right. You know, it seems like there was that huge shift to doing things overseas, and now a lot of stuff has come back onshore.
Sure.
And you know, it's a critical element of the training side of things that we need to deal with.
I think so. And you know, a lot of it also, these are good problems to have, right? I mean, especially in the southeastern U.S., you've seen several large manufacturers move their facilities here. So that also has soaked up a lot of the available labor. So, I mean, these are good problems. We just have to figure out how to get through them.
Yeah. You mentioned that time when you kind of hit the desk, so to speak. You know, there's definitely highs and lows of being an entrepreneur. Talk about a few of your personal keys to success, you know, as you've kind of managed your business and led your business, you know, to the heights that you've seen.
I think probably, you know, from a personnel standpoint, a lot of it is just letting people do what they're good at, right? So if that, and not getting in the way of them doing their job and achieving their highest performance. So I think that's been a critical element for sure. But if there was one piece of, I guess, advice or one kind of thought that always sticks with me, is my father once told me that, you know, things are never as good as they seem nor as bad as they seem. And that's especially when you're, you know, 24 years old or 22, however old I was, and had your head on the table. I mean, it's a lot of times it's hard to heed that advice and remember it. But I think to a large extent that's true. I mean, when you look at everything from a 30,000 foot view, it looks more like a stock chart rather than a rocket ship or a stalled out airplane, right?
I mean, right.
But a lot of times it feels like you're in a stalled out airplane for sure.
Yeah.
Or a rocket ship.
Just have to keep pedaling.
That's right. Yeah. That's okay. Exactly right.
So. I guess Winston Churchill once said, an optimist sees the opportunity in every sees the opportunity in every difficulty. And, you know, that's kind of one of those things that sometimes a bad economy or sometimes, you know, shifting times can kind of create opportunity that we can take advantage of.
Oh, there's no question. I mean, that's when I started my company in a difficult time. And actually, I have, not that anyone wants to see difficult times, but I certainly think there's more opportunity to thrive and really stake your claim and figure out what direction you're going when things are a little bit more difficult.
Right.
And a lot of, especially early on in my business, a lot of our transactions were kind of deal based, right? So a lot of it's all about the buy side and how, you know, so especially on the commodity side, the plastic side, we make our money on the buy side and not necessarily on the sales side. I mean, it's not quite that cut and dry, but, you know, certainly the input costs when you're selling commodity is very, very important, and the relationships that are built around the supplier. So I always feel like it's a good time when you can establish those relationships and pay a fair price, but pay, you know, a good price for both the supplier and yourself. It's a lot easier to do that in difficult times, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully they'll remember that when things are a lot better.
Right, right. So there's a little bit of quid pro quo
exactly,
in there.
Or, exactly, yeah.
You know, kind of thinking back to those early times 15 years ago, talk about the state of entrepreneurism these days. You know, for somebody who's coming out of college and maybe thinking about taking the risk that you took a while ago, or you know, maybe a mid-career person who's thinking about doing something totally new.
Well, I will say, if you believe in yourself and you have an idea and there's no better time to do it than when you're right out of college and have no, what I call, not that overhead's not the correct word, but how about responsibilities?
Personal overhead, responsibilities.
There is no better time to take a risk and fail than when you really have nothing to lose. And if you believe in yourself, that's in my mind, the ideal time. And again, I was just really fortunate. I mean, I think a lot of entrepreneurs ultimately, and you know, you have an idea, but if the timing's not right and things don't just quite kind of fall into place, I mean, a lot of it has to do with just being very fortunate. And I was. And so, you know, I would encourage anyone out there who really does believe in themselves and believe in their idea. And if you've got the stomach for it, that's just a great time to do it.
Yeah.
There's no question. But it kind of an overall state right now. I mean, I have never been as optimistic about our country and our economy as I am today. I mean, if you look at it, you can turn on the news every night and hear whatever you want to hear. But
right.
The reality is, you know, in your perspective may be a little different being in the heavily regulated banking world. But, you know, yes, there are regulations. Yes, maybe some things a little different than they were 10 years ago. But, I mean, we are really set, in my opinion, in this country for a 30-year run, and nobody's expecting it. And I just think now is a fantastic time. I'm hugely optimistic about our economy and about our country. I'm excited for my children because I think they're going to be able to take part in that as well.
Yeah, I think that's the I share your optimism. I'm kind of by nature glasses half full kind of guy, but I think something has happened over the last couple of years. I'd love your perspective on it, but as it related to healthcare costs and taxes and regulation, some of the things that were unclear that have become more clear. Mm-hmm. My sense is that business leaders have just kind of said, okay, I know what the rules are. I may or may not agree with them, but I know what the ground rules are, and I'm just going to move forward and you know, put my foot on the accelerator. Is that kind of a little bit of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I definitely think so, and I think, you know, it kind of correlates as well. I mean, if you look at any cost or any, you know, taxes, whatever it is, just like you said, I mean, I think if there's clarity and people understand, then they can work around it. What gives everybody, you know, the heebie-jeebies is when they don't understand what's going to happen. I mean, Obamacare and all that was a great example. Same thing for oil prices. I mean, if they're $100, fine. If they're $50, that's fine. It's just the getting from the 100 to the 50 that's the difficult part. I mean,
right.
So I agree with you 100%. I mean, and of course, there's always going to be disruptions. And but I think this, the more static things can be and kind of remain in the same general ballpark, the easier it is to plan your business.
Yeah.
And
well, and I think this, you know, your industry aside, I think the element of the United States being more to much more energy independent has, I think, shifts the calculus a little bit from a future perspective, and that's definitely happened.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, people forget. I mean, we're still the world's largest economy. We're still, you know, kind of the home of entrepreneurism and innovation. And, you know, again, I think a lot of times people just don't realize how good they have it, and they may not until we don't have it. And they'll look back now and say, golly, do you remember when how great it was back then? You know, it's always the good old days, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been reading a book recently called The Entrepreneur Mind by a local business leader, Kevin Johnson. And I think he comments on 100 entrepreneurial qualities, but I wanted to read a couple quotes out of there and just get your response to it, because these were some of the things that jumped off the page at me a little bit. Jack Welch once said, "Change before you have to," and you know, it's really a comment about adapting to change quickly. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about how you guys adapt to change.
No, I think he's exactly right. So specifically, we constantly have to look at what we're doing, or at least I do, and attack it, right? And think about, are we doing this the correct way, and how could we be doing it better? Because if you're not out in front of the changes that are coming in the industry and just in general innovations, you're going to be behind. And
right.
For a small business, you can't afford to do that. So, you know, for me, it could be, you know, adding the correct employee that might expand our purchasing ability, mm-hmm. or getting us into different, you know, markets, hard service, things like that, or different type of polymers, things of that nature. So, I mean, that's a great quote. And I think you have to wake up every morning and kind of analyze what you're doing and make sure that, you know, it might work today, but in 3 or 4 years, it may not.
Yeah.
So I think that's very true.
Another one was, I particularly like this one. Victor Kiam, the old owner of the Patriots, said, "Procrastination is opportunity's natural assassin." obviously making the point about not wasting time. How do you create a culture of urgency in your company?
You know, I think it's just naturally built into my personality, if you will. I mean, you know, it kind of always starts from the customer. So we are always urgent with our customer. If the customer needs something or, you know, calls in an order, I mean, an order will never sit for more than 2 seconds. Either it's going to get put on a back order and we'll figure out how to fill it, or it'll get turned into production quickly. I mean, we just, you know, and that's just always how I've been. And that's not just with customers and not just in business. I mean, it's just get it done and move on to the next thing. I mean, that's right. Just always kind of been my persona. Now, my wife might disagree with you if the garbage needs to be taken out.
I have an idea that she might have a honey-do list for you somewhere that has a few items on it.
But you know, there's no money to be made on that honey-do list, so that's the difference.
Okay. Well, maybe she has to inject some entrepreneurialism into the
It's just like
honey-do.
I tell everybody, you know, I was a horrible math student, I mean, throughout my whole life, but I did great in entrepreneurial finance, and they asked me why. So if you put a dollar sign in front of the numbers, it starts to make more sense for me.
There you go. Okay. Another one that's a challenge, I think, for every leader is, particularly in the stage of emerging from those go-go initial years into a more mature business, is mm-hmm. a concept that Michael Gerber talks about in a book called E-Myth, and it's working on your business, not in your business.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you're kind of at this very interesting stage in the development of the two legs of your business. Talk about that a little bit, you know, because so much of your job is seeing what's next. And sometimes there's probably the day-to-day elements of things that pull you down more on the business.
John, I feel like you need to have a sofa and just lay down and close my eyes and tell you about them, because that's exactly where we are as a company right now. And it is a struggle. So I think and I'm not going to have a great answer for you, because literally I'm right in the midst of trying to figure out where we go from here. So we are in that kind of crunch area where we're not small anymore, but we're definitely not big. And there's certain things that we're lacking that, you know, frankly, I'm not sure if I'm the right guy to provide it. So maybe if we have part two of a radio interview, I'll tell you what direction I went. But yeah, I mean, that is a struggle for me. So for example, you know, when our machine is broken down, I want to be the guy, you know, looking under there with the maintenance crew to figure out what's going on. And
right.
at the end of the day, is that the best use of my time? Probably not, but I still...
You still need to do it because it's an issue that needs to be addressed.
Obviously. Sure, but I mean, can I fix it? There's no, I mean, I'm not mechanically inclined. There's no way I could fix it, but I'm just feel the pull and the draw to, you know, what I've created. And so I think that there's a lot of that, that every morning when I wake up, I have to figure out, and we're working through this year, especially is kind of a transition year for that. So,
yeah, well, it seems like the challenge is to create time to even think about that stuff. And so sometimes good ideas happen in strange places.
Exactly.
Watching a baseball game or something like that or whatever.
Maybe so.
this has really been helpful to me. What's next for the company? What are some of your aspirations for the next few years?
Well, I think, you know, obviously I'd like to, you know, always say that it's not just about doubling the size of the company. It's can we grow it in a smart and profitable manner? So I would like to double the size, certainly of the plastics business and grow the flooring side where it makes sense. But can we do it in a manner that makes sense? Mm-hmm. Smart growth is what I like to call it. So I have some revenue goals and some other metrics that I hope to achieve. But I think really the overarching theme, and this is since 2008, since we moved into our manufacturing facility, is creating and building something that is a great place, not just for myself, but for our employees and just building something that will last. I think in the back of my mind, that's just kind of the overarching theme. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's both, you know, obviously you want to be profitable and but we're in the investing phase of my company, I believe. So.
Right. One last question on Manassas. How did you come up with the name?
What's the importance of Manassas? There's really no importance. So I'm just a huge history buff, and I actually started the company name out as FiberTech, and we went to incorporate that name, and apparently there was a pool company in Georgia that already had the name. So my attorney at the time told me, he says, well, whatever you name it, just make it unique. And I was, you know, I'm an old history buff, as I said, and I was reading a book about the Battle of Manassas. So I said, well, just call it Manassas Textiles. He said, well, that's great. Nobody ever will think of that. So, so that's kind of how that's how it got started. But, you know,
now, I don't remember the history of the Battle of Manassas.
Well, it's just the first battle of the Civil War. So I just thought, well, you know, this is the first company I've ever started. So we'll just, you know, term it that. But
there you go.
Honestly, I have to tell you, you know, when you're 21 years old and sitting in college, I didn't know if it was going to last a week or a month or 15 years. This is our 15th year in business. So.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you.
We aspire to your longevity at Atlantic Capital Bank.
Yeah, well,
coming up on our eighth year.
I appreciate that. But so no, there's no real symbolism there. It's just a name.
Okay. Well, you've already told me some great advice from your father, so I won't ask you my best advice, question unless you want to add someone else.
I think that's a pretty good one.
That was a good one. Yeah. And then, but I would like to shift to the speed round where I just ask you some quick questions.
Sure.
What'd you want to be when you're growing up? Before you got into college and decided to start your business?
You're not going to believe this. I wanted to be this. I mean, I really did always wanted to. Yeah, I was always the guy. When I was, you know, 8 years old, I had a toy store, and then I had a video rental store, and then I, you know, always wanted to own my own company. So this is what I want to be. I'm living my, I guess, boyhood dream.
Do you think that was partly because of the history of your family and growing up with your father and uncle and grandfather and observing that?
I think maybe so. I don't know. I don't know. I've just always, I think that certainly played a role in it. And I've just always been fascinated with the great game, if you want to call it that, right? The pursuit of making money and creating things that make money. And I've just, I can remember that when I was 4 years old in kindergarten, you know, all the kids would write what they wanted for Christmas, and I wrote a piggy bank on my thing, you know, that type of thing. I've just always been fascinated by the pursuit of money.
Have there been resources over the years that you look back on and say, boy, that was really foundational?
You know, I joined EO, Entrepreneurs Organization, here in Atlanta, mm-hmm. And I think certainly some of the people I met through that organization have really helped, you know, on a personal relationship standpoint and professionally, just helped me grow as a person and a business for sure.
Yeah.
That's a great resource. And if there are any entrepreneurs out there, I definitely encourage you to join that. And, you know, just I went to UGA. I got a degree in finance. And I just think learning how to think about things, how to think about time and how to think about money, that as far as the best use of your time is was really foundational for me in going forward and creating something.
Yeah. Fascinating. What about, you know, favorite charity or institution that you're supporting these days?
Well, actually the Boys and Girls Club is kind of dear to both my wife and I's heart. And we support, it's a program called Money Matters, and it's actually through Charles Schwab. And we do that through the Boys Club, and it is financial literacy for kids. And I think, you know, that's something that's severely lacking in today's schools. And so that's, if I had one thing to point to, that would definitely be it. I mean, it's a great program.
Is that a program that's kind of an after school program through the Boys?
It is,
yeah. Girls School, Girls Club.
That's okay. Right. And so it's voluntary, and they sign up and they have, it's I think every quarter, and they graduate, quote unquote. And then, it's great. And actually it's a fantastic read. I mean, you pick up that workbook and I think, you know, I hadn't read some of this since I was in college and I kind of forgot this and I learned that. But so these kids are learning it anywhere from ages, you know, 11 to 16. So it's a great time to hear and otherwise maybe they would hear it, but maybe they wouldn't. But it certainly can't hurt. I'm pretty sure they're not getting a lot of that in school. So,
and it's probably something that we all need to hear again and again.
Yeah, right? No question.
Absolutely. What about a favorite movie?
Oh, gosh. everybody's going to laugh at me. You know, I love Last of the Mohicans. I love The Godfather, but everybody asks me my favorite movie, and sheepishly, I always kind of have to go back to Top Gun.
There you go. Well, I must say, I was channel surfing the other night, and that was on, and I stopped for a while and watched 15 or 20 minutes. You can't pass up Top Gun.
Exactly. Although I watched The Imitation Game the other night. That's a fantastic movie.
That was a great movie. And remarkable that was, you know, he was the father of what we think of as modern-day computing.
Yeah, it was very interesting.
Fascinating. JT, thanks. This has been really great to kind of get your perspective on your company, but also on entrepreneurism. It's just remarkable to hear your story and hear how you've developed your business over the years. Tell our listeners how they can get in contact with you or learn more about Manassas Textiles.
Well, if you check our website, manassastextiles.com, you kind of have to Google it, learn how to spell it, but it's Manassas Textiles with an S.com. Check us out there, or I guess I don't know if I need to get my phone number out over there. Okay. That's the best way.
That's the best way to get you. Okay, fantastic. Well, thanks again. This has been a lot of fun. Join us again next week for another Founders Club broadcast sponsored by Atlantic Capital Bank and powered by Business Radio X.